So, good evening. Glad you're all here. I should maybe begin by saying a little bit about what philosophy is. Maybe some of you have already heard this bit, but just a few things. What is philosophy is a huge question, and it's typical of philosophers not to have settled it one way or the other. It's one question that every philosopher has a different answer to. And I'm not going to go into it a great deal. I just want to say a few things about it that help, I think, with the class and with your expectations, perhaps. Hopefully you'll get a sense of what philosophy is really in a deeper way just by doing it and by participating in the course. But one thing that's maybe important, particularly in the Philosophy of the Person course, is to distinguish it from psychology or sociology or anthropology. Those are, by and large, empirical sciences, whereas philosophy is not. So psychology, for instance, aims at finding out how the soul and the mind work and finding out ways of improving the way it functions or of healing it when it breaks down. Philosophy is not practical like that. It doesn't have an immediate purpose to make the mind function properly. It simply asks, what is the person in at its core, at its most fundamental being? What are we? Who are we? And how must we live, therefore? So it's aimed at understanding, and of course that will have fruit. In fact, this is the way Katie and I got into philosophy. We took, while we were in love, a Nature of Love course. What?
Way back when we were in love.
I didn't imply any short duration. We took this Nature of Love course, and it just shed floodlights of on our experience. And so it's the fruit in daily living that attracted us to philosophy, in not just practical fruit, but just understanding one's own life and one's relation to others, that's very important. So there is fruit. It does affect practical life, but that's not the immediate aim. That is a superabundant result, you could say, of philosophy, and is not the thing that justifies it, like psychology. Psychology that isn't practical might as well be tossed out. It simply doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Also, psychology, anthropology, sociology, they do a lot of experimentation, observation, testing, various cases. They do a lot of historical research. You know, anthropologists go to various places and study tribes and compare their lifestyles and see if they have an ethical code and all these sorts of things. None of that we need to do. We can just sit here in this room and reflect on our own experience, really. It's not, we don't have to go far away to have the source material for philosophy of the person. We are persons, we relate to persons, we grew up maybe in a family, we live in a community of some sort, we meet people in stores and so on. And so we have all that's necessary to meaningfully philosophize about the human person. So philosophy also starts with experience, but not with experimentation. Right? If we want to know whether you have a self, I'm not going to shake you or put you on a scale or something like that, or measure you. We know that we have a soul simply by reflecting on our experience. We know that we are free simply by thinking about the way we act and about the feelings of responsibility that we have and so on. So we start with experience, we try to stay close to experience and try to understand it. That is to say, we try to go through this experience to what it implies about the being of the person. Right? So it's not a mere description of experience, as is sometimes thought. It is a dwelling and getting into an understanding what that experience reveals about the reality. In this case, the reality of personal selfhood. So an important result of that is that what's being said here, either by me or by others, shouldn't be completely novel, unheard of, totally strange. If something is totally strange, if it doesn't ring a bell, I'm probably wrong, right? Challenge me on it. Because philosophy really does nothing other than illumine, shed light on something that in some way, pre-philosophically, we already know. All right, so so that's an important practical consequence of the nature of philosophy, that anyone, any student, has access to the facts and can test them in light of his own experience. Unlike a history thing, say, or a language professor, if somebody tells me that canus means dog, I'm not going to say, hold, that doesn't jive with my experience. That makes no sense. Why? Because that's just a piece of information that I can't know unless somebody tells me. But if somebody tells me all, I don't know.
There's no difference between love and lust, for instance. You can
yes,
say.
Then I can challenge that based on my own experience of things. All right, so those are just a few remarks about philosophy, and they are very incomplete, but enough maybe for our purposes. Hold on, I forgot a few more points. The next point is to say that philosophy is not theology. So I've said it's not psychology, not an empirical science like that. It's also not theology. While the material in this course is harmonious with Christianity and enlightened by Christianity, it is not based on Christianity. That's a key distinction. Theologians take revelation as a given, as a starting point for their science. It's the source of their thinking. Theology is faith seeking understanding. Philosophy doesn't begin with faith. It rather begins with the reality as they encounter it in the world. In this case, again, persons. And so they try to understand reality based on their own reason, their own insight, and of course that the insight of other philosophers and people around them, but without relying on faith as a first principle or premise of their reasoning. All right? That basic distinction is very important. Once you have that clear, it's also important to see that philosophy benefits in many ways from theology, from faith. The opposite is also true. Theology benefits from philosophy, but that's not my concern here. One way in which we benefit from the faith is simply by some of the concepts that we use. The whole idea of person, as some of you may know, is really a theological concept. The Greeks didn't have the concept of person. They spoke about human nature, about mankind, and so on, but not much about personhood. It was, I mean, again, generalizing, reducing a complex reality, you could say it's reflecting, Christians reflecting on the mystery of the Trinity and the mystery of the Incarnation that brought to light and made them look for a new concept that fits a new reality, namely personhood. If you think of the Trinity, for instance, what is the Trinity? Well, it is three persons, but one nature. The Greeks, with their philosophical terminology, couldn't make any sense of that. There is just human nature, and every human nature is an individual, right? So when you talk about the Trinity, you have one nature, three what? Three persons. But that was a contribution made through years of controversy and fighting and whatnot, blood and tears, I'm sure, suffering. And yet, now we have it. So that's something we have because of the fathers of the church reflecting on the faith. Also the Incarnation. There you have the opposite. There you have one person, two natures. And maybe also there you can already see one, at least I find this helpful when I think about these two doctrines. You can see the distinction between what we are and who we are. So the nature refers to what we are, human nature. That's what we are, what faculties we have, what powers we have, what possibilities. Who we are is a fundamentally different question. It asks after not the nature that we share with other human beings, but about our unique identity as persons. And so this difference between what we are and who we are, or between the nature and the individual who owns and uses that nature, those are very different questions. And again, one has to do with personhood, the other, I think, more with nature. Okay, just two other points. Freedom, of course, is another essential characteristic now of that we now ascribe to persons. Persons are free, non-persons are not free. But a real understanding of freedom also has much to gain from the Christian faith. The drama of salvation, sin, the reality that everything rides on our free decision, our eternal fate rides on that decision. That it sort of increases the stakes and heightens the difference between something for which I'm responsible and something for which I'm not responsible. That is something that the Greeks had an inkling of. You know, they grappled with it, but it was made much more precise and much clearer through Christians reflecting on something like sin. And then one more example, the idea of solidarity. Again, it's natural reason without the aid of faith can think of ways in which human beings are dependent on one another, which human beings are like one another, which human beings are social animals. That's very clearly there in Plato and Aristotle. But if you think about the fact that through Adam, all people now all of a sudden are infected with original sin, that is a kind of solidarity I think the Greeks could make no sense of. How is that possible? And even more remarkable, the reverse of all that, that through the merits of Jesus, all of us are now saved, redeemed. It connects, in other words, every human being to every other human being in a way that is highly mysterious. I'm not claiming that I understand it or that any philosopher understands it, but it does, I think, provide rich material for reflection. It sheds light on how deep human solidarity really goes. How every act that I commit, particularly every sin or every good thing that I do, affects the whole body and not just my own selfhood or those that are immediately around me. Okay, so philosophy is in many ways indebted to faith. Now, I should add to those. So the concept of solidarity, freedom, personhood, we get those either through theology or they are heightened and deepened through theology. The point is now that a philosopher, once light has been shed on these realities, can now look at it with his own natural reasoning, based on his own experience. In other words, once theology and faith has enlightened the world, that light is there for everyone to see, not just the theologians. You don't have to start anymore with theological principles as a basis. It's like theology acts, you could say, as a kind of flashlight, right? So I can't see an object until the light goes on. But now that I see it directly. I don't have to hold the flashlight or turn it on or look at it, know how it works. None of that. I can just look at the object that's now illumined. So theologians have much more to do with the flashlight, you could say, whereas philosophers simply benefit from the light and relate to the object illumined immediately and through their natural reason. And that, of course, too, natural reason. Who knows whether my reason is and how much it is enlightened by grace? These questions, again, I don't need to ask. I just use it. And that is in no way a problem for philosophy. It doesn't make philosophy a kind of amateur theology. Okay, one more. Well, this is no longer about theology, philosophy, or the nature of it. I just want to say a limitation of the course And this makes it slightly different from the previous one I taught. I wanted to teach a course on philosophy of community. And in thinking about that, and I still need to do a lot of thinking about that, I thought one of the presuppositions for that course is an understanding of the person. You can't get community until you first get personhood, it seems to me. And so this course will focus almost exclusively on the individual person. I will at various points bring up how that is related to other persons and to community and so on, to God, but it's not the main focus, and so that's a limitation of the course. It is followed by a philosophy of community, but clearly, to get a full picture of what a person is, you need also to have a sense of the dependency, the relatedness of persons to a whole community. So if you want the full thing, then you either should come to the next course or read something more on community. All right, a bit more about the structure of the course. I will begin, and this follows very much Crosby's own book. I'll begin by the reality of personal selfhood, what it means and what it implies. One reason I like that approach is because it immediately connects us with the most central theme, it seems to me, in modern philosophy and modern culture in general. I think modernity, modern man, is very much occupied in one way or another with the problem of selfhood, the problem of freedom, independence, autonomy, human rights, authenticity, and so on. All these questions, these phenomena, play a huge role in the development of modern man, culture, and philosophy. And I entitled this first session "The Developing Sense of Self," because that's how I understand, sort of positively, much of modern philosophy and modern thought in general. I think it is the best way of approaching both the positive and the negative aspects of it, as to see it as a growing, deepening sense of self, and that is to state the positive aspect of it. But that, of course, then goes together with lots of growing pains, lots of people going off the rails, and so on and so forth. All that is true, too. Those are the negative aspects of it. But to view them as growing pains, so to speak, is still somehow to keep your eyes on that it's that there's a positive development lying underneath all of that. So I think this is, it seems to me both a hopeful way of looking at it. I think it's also borne out by studying the period. It's also, I think, what the Church basically does say in Vatican II. I have here a quote from what seems to be the most central document of Vatican II, which is the Declaration on Religious Freedom. In paragraph 9, it says that this document on man's right to religious freedom is based on the dignity of the person, the demands of which have become more fully known to human reason through centuries of experience. So it seems to me that's a pretty direct statement of what I've been saying. Again, this is not overlooking all the issues, all the trouble, all the bad things that have been going on in modern philosophy, but it is, it seems to me, a kind of key of interpreting it well and with a sense of hope and also a sense of
justice.
Just as in a kind of credit of faith to philosophers, usually, there are some philosophers, I'm sure, with bad will, just like there are people everywhere with bad will. But by and large, people have questions and want to answer them. They try to answer them according to their best lights, and they go off the rails. We all do that, some people worse than others. But there's still, there's some urge, something they want, some problem they want to deal with and want to answer. And altogether, it seems to me, humanity sort of slowly but surely has done some progressing, has done some learning, and now the question is, can we sift through and sift out all the mistakes and the errors and move forward without them? Here I have another quote. This one comes from Love and Responsibility, page 23, at least in my crummy copy, which is falling apart here. But this is the one you can buy now. It's probably the same pagination. I don't know. So here's what Wojtyła says very early on in the book. A human person establishes contact with all other entities, with all of reality, precisely through the inner self. Right? So there's the selfhood-reality relation. And then he says this. In his whole relationship with this world, with reality, he, that is the person, strives to assert himself, his I, and he must act thus, since the nature of his being demands it. So, I like that quote, for one thing, because it was the first time I heard self-assertion as a positive thing. I mean, clearly, Wojtyła says there's something positive here in self-assertion. But what's going on here, I think Wojtyła has experience of people feeling somehow, intuiting, that their selfhood is being denied, violated, ignored, squashed, not giving elbow room, whatever it may be. And they struggle with this and they want to find ways of asserting their self, that is, of maintaining their own integrity as selves in their relations to all of reality, truth, other persons, goodness, ethics, God, and so on. So that is not essentially, that is not necessarily a rebellion. Feeling this urge to assert yourself is something that your nature as a human person demands. That, I think, is a very key insight of Wojtyła, and I think it's one reason why his philosophy has been so influential and is so so insightful, especially for problems we deal with nowadays. All right, so I hope you like that quote as much as I do. Now, but more about the structure of the course. So I've explained now why I'm beginning with the sense of selfhood. That's to connect with the modern world, you could say. But I also then afterwards, probably beginning in the third lecture or so, will talk about the way in which this developing sense of selfhood has been played off against other equally important truths about reality, about the person. So I just give a list here. There's the reality, importance of truth, very often the emphasis on the person, on his autonomy and freedom, leads to a neglect of truth. Somehow, people feel that to insist on the universality of truth, how can that go together with the unicity, the individuality, the uniqueness of the person? How can a truth that's true for all men be also true for me? So there seems to be a contradiction there, a tension, and or subjectivity, inner life, and objectivity, objective truth. What does something out there have to do with my interiority, you could say? So, subjectivity and truth, person and truth, that's a relation we'll have to deal with. The self and the good, that's another one. That there is something out there which is objectively good is hard for many to see and to square with the idea of selfhood. Or you could say, doesn't this concern with myself, my selfhood, doesn't that lead essentially to egoism, egocentrism? Or what about very often this the quest for goodness, the quest for moral goodness or for sanctity, to speak in faith-filled terminology, is described in terms of imitating Christ or imitating the saints. So a modern question would be, how is this imitating of other people going to help me be true to myself? What does authenticity have to do with other people? Isn't this kind of imitating of the saints or imitation of Christ, isn't that a kind of radical denial of my selfhood? Isn't it imposing an alien model on my unique self? Don't I lose what's given to me, especially when I imitate another person? So those, I hope you can see, are real questions, and we'll try to deal with them somehow. Then there's the self and the body. This is extremely important nowadays, especially in medical, in the medical context. The body, what does the body, this biological thing, have to do with the free spirit, the free self that is somehow tied to it, connected to it? It seems to subject us to mere biology, and here we are free, dignified human beings. So many people think that, and they often call themselves personalists, like I do, call myself. They say that personalism requires that we use the body for our own ends. Whatever we want to do with it, what we feel is the best thing to do with it, that's what we should do. The idea of respecting the body, of obeying its nature, of conforming to it in one way or another, is precisely to give up on the person. It's to voluntarily subject myself to something which is below me, namely mere biology. So there's another problem that we'll need to come to terms with, the embodiment of the person. Why is the unity of body and self not a problem, but a fruitful and good thing? Then there's the self and other persons, the self and community. Insistence, I think, of being on people's insistence of being true to themselves, of being faithful to the call they think they have been given, very often leads to tensions with other people. It breaks up communities. It has all sorts of negative effects like that. I mean, think of Thomas More, who was sort of chided by his friends for, how does he put it?
Come along for fellowship.
Yeah, breaking up the fellowship. I mean, he wasn't being a very nice, companionable guy in insisting on this silly thing of his conscience. So, and Kierkegaard makes a lot of it. He talks about the world, the community sort of wants the self to be a smooth rolling coin that makes no trouble, and instead it is this infinitizing angular self that always gets in the way and doesn't quite fit the hole we want to put it in, and so on. So, again, insistence on selfhood, authenticity, conscience, all these things often cause trouble for relations with others, for communities. And then lastly, there is the self and God. Again, modern atheism, at least some forms of it, are very often, they have in some ways personalist grounds. People think that the notion of an all-seeing God wrecks any idea of privacy, for instance. How can I have sort of a room to myself, some kind of privacy, some area in my life that's where I can just be with myself without God prying all the time? That is a sense that someone like Sartre feels very strongly, and it causes him to deny God. He denies God not so much because there's an argument against his existence, but rather because he says, if God exists, I cannot exist. It's a kind of struggle. It's either he or me. All right? So we'll talk about that later. Also, freedom, of course. Or how is freedom compatible with God's foreknowing? He knows what I'm going to do tomorrow. How does that leave me free? He is the cause of all things. He upholds me in all ways, makes my acting possible. How can I be free in that? And so on. So there's another problem. Now, my aim in dealing with these, and of course, there's so many topics, I will deal with all of them you know, sort of in an introductory way. The aim in all of it will be to show not only that there is no conflict, but to show rather that precisely through a deepened sense of selfhood, all these relations to truth, goodness, community, God, and so on, can be better understood. They can be deepened and enhanced. So far from a deepened sense of selfhood leading to the denial of these transcendent goods, they are the only proper basis to protect them, you could say. So, in other words, each of these dialectical relations between self and good, self and truth, self and other persons, each of those dialectical relations, if understood properly, you'll see that the other enhances, improves, perfects the self, and likewise, a deepened self enhances our transcendence, our relation to the good, the true, and all these other things, and to the body. All right, so none of those things are the enemy of selfhood. All of them are the friend of selfhood. All right, that's all I want to say by way of introduction.